Good morning, everybody. It is September 9th, 2021. This is your home away from homeroom, your daily homeroom, your ADK homeroom, and I'm your host, the teacher in exile, Frank. I'm coming to you straight out of the heart of the Adirondacks here. And I have an absolute banger of an episode for you today. We're going to do the science fact of the day. It's a classic. We're going to do Australia's fall into tyranny. We're going to talk a little bit about mass and morality. We're going to talk about other big news, soccer, the three big trials coming on. Lots of commentary on the news. Then we're going to do the promised further look into the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, the notorious FDA. Perhaps they are public enemy number one at this point. How it's failing us, and the heinous cost of our regulatory burden. So let's get right into it today. Today's science fact of the day, the slogan is facta, 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 facta. 58 times more there, right there. Facta, that's right. It's a nod to Kanye and Donda. Brilliant, absolutely brilliant, Donda. Go give it a listen. If you're not enjoying that, I have to feel like you're just not being honest with yourself. Oh, what a brilliant piece of art right there. So it's science fact of the day today. There is gravity in orbit, and the International Space Station should really be called the International Fuzz Station. And the space shuttle, when it was flying up there, should really be called the Fuzz Shuttle. Why, you ask? Well, because if the Earth were the size of a peach, that International Space Station is at such a low altitude that it would not be above the fuzz on a peach. If the Earth were the size of a tennis ball, the tennis ball also has fuzz, the International Space Station would still be orbiting within the fuzz. It is a really low altitude thing. It's basically just a really high plane, high enough for the sky to be dark around it and for politicians to use it as a point of prestige and geopolitical one-upsmanship. But as far as useful science, it is not a science platform. It is a very, very low altitude. It's the fuzz station, and the space shuttle when it was flying was the fuzz shuttle. You have to keep in mind, right, if the Earth were the size of a pool ball, the Earth would be smoother than a pool ball, a billiard ball, right? You know how smooth that white cue ball is, or that black eight ball? That's how smooth the Earth is. You know, that's including Mount Everest. That's including the Mariana Trench. The Earth's radius compared to those slight imperfections, the Mount Everest and trenches and things like that, the Earth's radius is so much bigger that those little bumps on the surface, they look big to us because we're the size of a human. Earth looks flat to us. But the Earth is extremely smooth. And at that sort of scale, the things look a little bit different. And when the space station is up there, when the shuttle is up there, it's really, really, really low altitude, even though it's still in orbit, even though people call it space, anything above 100 kilometers, anything above 62 miles an hour, they call it space. It's really still in the fuzz of the peach. And there is gravity there. People say that that's a zero gravity environment. It is not, of course, a zero gravity environment. If you want to convince yourself of this, just ask yourself one question. What holds the fuzz station in orbit? Gravity. Of course there is gravity there. A fuzz station is being held in orbit by gravity. So how come it looks like there is zero gravity there? Because everything's falling together, right? The space station and the people inside of it and the orange juice inside of it, if they squirt a little orange juice out to make a blob, that is all falling together. Just imagine you're on a roller coaster and the roller coaster starts to fall straight down. I know roller coasters don't go straight down. Imagine it did, ignoring air resistance, go straight down. And at the same time, it starts to go straight down. Take a little piece of silly putty, something soft, and let it go right next to your ear. And as you go down in the roller coaster, the silly putty will fall at the same rate you do. Remember, things on Earth, near any mass, will accelerate the same regardless of their mass. Everything falls down at 10 meters per second squared, 9.8 meters per second squared, 32 feet per second of speed gained every second. So when you're falling down that roller coaster and you release a blob right next to your face as you're falling down, it will look like the blob is floating next to you. If that hill is long enough, you're falling down towards the center of the Earth. The blob is falling down towards the center of the Earth at the same rate. It will look like the blob is floating next to your ear. And that's what's going on in the space station. Everybody's falling towards the center of the Earth at the same rate. So it looks like they're floating next to each other as they're falling. Now, the last question you probably have then is, if they're falling towards the center of the Earth, how come they don't hit the ground? Well, because falling towards the center of the Earth is not all that they're doing. They're also moving sideways really fast. Remember, they were launched up there by a rocket, and that rocket gave them a lot of, for lack of a better word, sideways speed. So as they fall towards the center of the Earth, the fuzz station is also, and everything in it is also, zooming toward the side. And by the time it falls down and hits the center of the Earth, the surface of the Earth, hits the surface of the Earth, fire explosion? No, it doesn't happen, because by the time the fuzz station would have hit the surface of the Earth, it has moved sideways over the horizon. That's really what orbit is the fact that you're moving so fast sideways that by the time you fall into the surface of the Earth, you're beyond the horizon. Once you get beyond the horizon, guess what? The surface isn't there. You're out in the middle of space again, on a different side of the planet. So then what do? Well, you fall towards the center of the planet, right? Gravity doesn't turn off just because you've moved over there. You're falling towards the center of the planet again. But guess what? You're out in space. There's very little friction to slow you down. You've got inertia. You are going to continue moving sideways too. So you continue moving sideways while you fall towards the center of the Earth. And by the time you fall towards the center of the Earth, your speed has carried you around the horizon again. And that's what people mean when they say that when you're in orbit, you're constantly falling towards the center of the Earth. So there's tons of gravity out at the fuzz station. It's really not very high up at all. It's not above the fuzz on a tennis ball, the fuzz on a peach, if the Earth were the size of a tennis ball or a peach. There's tons of gravity there. It's holding you in orbit. And orbit is really just falling towards the center of the Earth while you are moving at constant velocity. You're accelerating towards the center of the Earth, but you're moving at constant velocity sideways, fast enough so that by the time you would have collided with the surface of the Earth, you are over the horizon. And that is today's facto, science fact of the day. It's brilliant. Go listen to it. Now let's move into our first item for the day, commenting on the news, Australia. You know, Australia, everybody's joking about it. They started off as a penal colony, a prison. They are returning to that same state, the once and future penal colony. That is Australia. It is so hard to get in or out of Australia. If you're in Australia right now, you are basically trapped, right? The state governments of Australia are taking over. And for example, this is, you know, they have armed patrols, the military patrolling the borders between the states, not letting you move anywhere. They have just tremendously dismaying a loss of rights there. They're going against, you know, their own principles. If you find various sites on Australia's government pages, you can find places that say, you know, Australians are entitled to move. You can never be required to stay in one place. But of course, that's exactly what they're doing. For example, in South Australia, the premier there has a new app out, or the developing app, about to publish it, that everyone in South Australia, the capital is Adelaide, this is kind of in the south central portion. Have you noticed a theme to today's episode? This is kind of in the south central portion of Australia, and this app that everybody's going to be forced to download, it has facial recognition and GPS built into it, and then the state government is going to send you random texts at random times. They will not tell you when, they will not tell you how many, and you get a text, and then you have 15 minutes to take a picture of yourself and upload it into the app, and it will check your with facial recognition to make sure that you are where you're supposed to be, which is probably just in your house, because everybody in Australia is on house arrest. It's been on and off for 18 months now. Connor Friedersdorf in The Atlantic wrote about it. Alex Tabarrok has talked about it. All kinds of people have been talking about it. It's absolutely horrific what's going on over there. And people, of course, as always in cases like this, they think they're doing the right thing by sacrificing their freedom. So we're going to play the which is easier game right now. Which is easier, getting out of Afghanistan or getting out of Australia? We all saw what happened in Afghanistan. Absolutely tragic. People falling off airplanes, climbing over themselves to try to get out of Afghanistan. Of course, the United States just last month did end up managing. It was bungled, and it caused deaths. Very, very sad, very tragic. But the United States did get out 125,000 people just last month from Afghanistan. Meanwhile, during the entire first half of 2021, from June, fewer than 100,000 people, about 98,000-99,000 people, were allowed to leave Australia. Of course, that included people like Nicole Kidman. The elite get special treatment under these schemes. Is that okay? My opinion, no. It is wrong. It's evil. But there are many people who are defending Australia, saying it's okay, it's because it's democratic. Well, this, of course, begs the question, what if the 70% vote to, you know, imprison permanently the 30%? Or what if 80% vote to imprison 100%? As seems to be happening in Australia right now. You know what? I hate to give you a first grade message here, but if everybody chooses a wrong thing, it's still a wrong thing. We learned this in first grade. We learned this in kindergarten, or at least we should have. Absolute democracy is tyranny. It's not okay. So yeah, I have to say it's easier to get out of Afghanistan. And I'm not trying to make light of the Afghanistan situation. That was terrible. I was extremely disappointed the way that happened. U.S. government, just terrible, bad job there. But more people out of Afghanistan in this year than out of Australia. In fact, just last month, the hardest month, way more out of Afghanistan than the entire first 6 months of the year coming out of Australia. Those stats about Australia, by the way, from the abs.gov.au site. Next question, which is easier, getting into Afghanistan or into Australia? Well, that same website says there have been about 103,000 arrivals in Australia throughout the first part of 2021, the first half of 2021. And now, of course, you've got quarantine fees in Australia of $2,330. If you are one of the lucky few, because they have a 40,000 long waiting list right now trying to get back into Australia, that's about half or 40% of the people who have been allowed in over the entire first half of the year. They've got a waiting list of 40,000 people, and each one coming back in is charged almost $2,500 for the privilege, because they have to stay at a hotel and be under quarantine, a militarily enforced quarantine, for their first 14 days before they go under house arrest at their house. And this quarantine is, for some reason, at like a five-star hotel like a Sheraton in Sydney or places like that. I read one article talking about how, you know, even prisoners get fresh air, but if you're in a high-rise hotel like the Sydney Sheraton, your windows are closed, you don't get even fresh air in there for 14 days straight. It's like jail. Ha-ha, do you see the theme? Do you see the theme of today's episode? It's like jail. So you get these stories, right? Among those 40,000 waiting to get back, about 200 are kids stuck away from their parents. There's a great story that's been reported on several websites like France 24 about Pumima Perry. Her son is 4. She hasn't seen him in 18 months. He's stuck in India. She's in Australia. They can't get together. She hasn't even seen her kid for 18 months, a year and a half, and he's only 4 years old. I've got to say, it's once again easier to get into Afghanistan, probably way easier to get into Afghanistan than it is to get into Australia right now. Next question. Which is easier, getting into or out of Afghanistan, or moving between states in Australia? Well, let's think about this story. Queensland just the other month, wouldn't let a 14-year-old double lung transplant through from New South Wales. Queensland's Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk said, "People living in New South Wales, they have New South Wales hospitals. In Queensland, we have Queensland hospitals for our people." She said that right before Queensland denied entry. They said they were going to grant a visa for it, but this is what always happens, right? They said they were going to grant a pass for him to come in and see his specialist, this 14-year-old double lung transplant. They were going to let him come see, but oh, darn it. The pass expired before he was allowed to come in, so they couldn't use it. Oh, but they tried. They really tried. Yeah, I'm sure they tried really hard. The truth is, though, still, I have to say, it's actually probably easier, as hard as it is, it's probably easier just by the numbers for some people to move between states in Australia, even though they have the military patrolling the borders, because they do have bubble regions. And these bubble regions allow people who live on the border of one state and another to cross through. Just those people, though. So I would say in terms of absolute numbers and crossings, it's maybe easier for those people in Australia. But I think if you exclude those people, once again, it's way easier to get into or out of Afghanistan than to get in or out of a state in Australia. And finally, which is easier, finding terrible examples of Australia being illiberal, unfree, being a tyrannical democracy, or convincing a statist that absolute democracy, tyranny of the majority, is a bad idea? That's the easiest question. Definitely the former. We've been so inundated from birth with this idea that democracy is great. Democracy is super. Of course, the United, we hear our politicians speak all the time, and they never talk about how important it is to keep the world safe for capitalism or how important it is to keep the world safe for natural rights. Instead, we always hear we have to establish democracy. We have to keep the world safe for democracy. The United States is a democracy. And of course, the United States has never been an absolute democracy. We have never had tyranny of the majority. Our Constitution was established specifically to protect the minority from the majority. That's what the Senate is about. That's what, in part, the Electoral College at some points of existence was intended to do. The Electoral College is an extremely murky and twisted history, of course, but in part, that's what it is intended to do, right? If Rhode Island doesn't feel safe joining your union, then Rhode Island is not going to join your union. You have to protect the minority. Absolute tyranny of the majority, absolute democracy does not allow for that. But it's really hard to convince people that have been taught this all their lives. It's hard to convince them that democracy is often overstepping its bounds and often working against what is best for people. That's right. I said it. Often democracy can work against what is best for people. That's why you need the rule of law. You need constitution to protect your minorities. Ironically, it's also the people who often say that they care so much for minorities who are in favor of the majority just running roughshod, trampling over the rights of the minorities. Let's move on to our next topic here in the news. Our next topic, I saw this on Facebook first, and of course it's true. There was a kindergarten teacher in 1938 in Los Angeles. Her name was Helen Hulick, and she needed to go into court for what reasons to testify, and she showed up in slacks. That's right. I believe it was Ogden Nash who wrote in the first part of the 20th century, "Ladies in slacks should not turn their backs." Well, Helen did, and she wore her slacks into the courtroom, and the judge was very upset. He held her in contempt of court. He said that she was corrupting the system. She was obstructing the judicial process. She was hurting others by wearing slacks. And of course, many people agreed with him, but Helen stood her ground to her credit. She said, "No way. These are my rights. I am going to wear my slacks." She even went to jail over it briefly, but she stood up for her rights. Her right to dress herself. By the way, did you notice the jail theme there? So her right to dress herself. And I have so many woke friends on Facebook. I'm old, right? I'm old, so I have a lot of friends on Facebook passing. And they're passing this around, these woke friends passing around this meme about Helen Hulick. And they're saying, "Oh, you go, girl. Let's go." They're actually not quite cool enough to use "let's go" in that sense. They use it still in the 20th century sense. But there's praising Helen Hulick for standing up against this person who's telling her she had to dress the way he said, because if she didn't, she was harming others. And then they're praising her for standing up for her rights to dress herself. This is where I'm doing my Rush Limbaugh finger drum, but I don't know if my audio is going to pick that up. But I'm drumming my fingers, and I'm giving the people's eyebrow to this. Why? Well, you know, because think about masks, right? The reason that people say you don't have the right to dress yourself, the reason people are saying that you must wear a mask is to protect others, right? And so you don't have a right to wear a mask. And yet, many of these same people are praising Helen Hulick for doing this in the 1930s. Now you might immediately say, oh, come on, Frank. We've got not wearing a mask. That could kill people. And we're just talking about, on the other hand, some lady wearing slacks. Okay, sure, you can make that argument, but in the 1930s, and even now, clearly disrupting the judicial process has a chance to kill people, right? Just look at what happened last summer. We had some pretty big upheavals in our judicial system last year, our justice system. Defund the police, you might remember that, and all of the attacks on the law enforcement and that system. And guess what? Murder rates have skyrocketed all across the nation. That is a cost in lives, and certainly there was a chance that judicial disruption resulted in that. So these two cases are not as dissimilar as you might think, my friends, and hypocrisy is never a good look. All right, my friends and droogs, that's it for that one. Hypocrisy is a no-no now. Now we are on to the Donda game, right? E. Paul Torrance, my guru for creativity, he's fantastic. And one of his other measures of creativity, we talked about flexibility the other day. He also talked about fluency. In other words, as many as you can think of in a category. So today we're going to test your fluency, see how many things you can think of in the category of epizeuxis. Epizeuxis, of course, is the deliberate repetition of a word in successive order for emphasis. And we're talking about Donda, 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 the start of Kanye West's album. It epitomizes epizeuxis, right? It uses that. So now here we go. You'll see how it goes. So you name this example of epizeuxis as we go through our five clues here. The first clue is Poe and tintinnabulation. All right, might have been an easy one to start with there. That is The Bells, right? His poem published posthumously. Oh, if Poe had only had another 10 years, what he could have done, right? The Raven was just published a couple of years before his death. He was really at the peak of his powers. So The Bells was our first clue for epizeuxis. Technically, it could be... okay, so let's go on to clue number two. Clue number two for epizeuxis, Michael Scott, When Toby Comes Back. Yes, it is no, 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 no. And then at the end, I think it's technically a diacope because he separates the repeated no with dear God, no, no, dear God, no. That's a diacope. But yeah, Michael Scott in the office rare with epizeuxis. Next clue. The clue is Horse Badortes and the Fan Man. Horse Badortes and the Fan Man. Correct answer is Dorky from the Dorky Day chapter of The Fan Man, that hippie novel by William Kotzwinkel, hippie 1970s book. You could also say man. That's repeated for emphasis a lot in that book. If you've never read it, it is so bad, it's good. And it's good in some ways, too. Just a really fascinating novel there. Next clue, Hamlet. I believe it is Act 2, Scene 2, when asked by that tedious old fool Polonius, what are you reading? Right, words, words, words. That's what Hamlet says, words, words, words. Wow, Shakespeare is so amazing, right? I mean, how much meaning is piled on top of those words, 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 and how little meaning. So awesome there. And finally, our last clue for epizeuxis, the Beatles song with the most epizeuxis that also best fits with Donda. Yes, the answer here has to be Let It Be. Let It Be, repeated deliberately for meaning, for emphasis and for meaning throughout there. The repetition, in fact, has meaning, and it's about a Christian mother, too. All right, I got to give one more here. One of my favorite poets, certainly an amazing working poet right now. We're going to say A.E. Stallings, Alicia Stallings. And the answer is Like. Yeah, her Sestina Like is amazing. Technically, maybe not Epizeuxis or even Diacult, but you have to check it out. Her Sestina Like is amazing. Let's go on to our next item here. So we've got three big trials coming up here. Some have already started, of course. These three big trials are, first, you've got Khalid Sheikh Mohammed finally coming to trial. 20 years ago, 9/11 happened. 20 years ago, as of 2 days from now. Just now, they're restarting the trial. And then the next trial, you have Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos. She had $9 billion invested in her company at one point. A lot of elite right-wing figures were in her circle, actually, and she had raised tremendous amounts of capital, but it was all built on lies, so she's going on trial for fraud. And France's ISIS attackers in the 2015 attacks, only one of them survives, but they've got one of the directly involved people survives. But there are other people also on trial there, I think 20 in total, although maybe about half of them are being tried in absentia. So here's the comment on the last two, or the two terrorism trials. These are not speedy trials, right? 20 years, this is not justice. This is not okay. This is a dysfunctional United States government and prosecution here. If this is really the process, and I'm not sure that it should be, but if this is really the process that you're going to pursue in the correct way to go after KSM and some other terrorists, you can't take 20 years to do it. That is not okay. Not just because of the Sixth Amendment, but also natural rights. U.S. government has to do better there. And France, a little better, 6 years only. It only took them 6 years to get to this trial. And, of course, the Theranos trial is a different thing. My comment there is more hypocrisy of a sort, because Elizabeth Holmes was praised as a, you know, amazing woman, amazing businessman, amazing scientist. She was going to inspire all these girls to go into STEM, which, by the way, if you include medical care, there are way more females in STEM than males in the United States in STEM fields. As long as you include the medical fields, there are way more females. Most people think that's not true. It's really just computer science and physics and the physical engineering, physical sciences like that, where males dominate. So people were praising Elizabeth Holmes, and now guess what her defense for her trial is going to be? Her defense for her trial is going to be that, she's so weak that she couldn't stand up for herself. She was the CEO, but her COO, who also happened to trick her into dating him, was dominating her so much that she couldn't think for herself, and she's really not responsible for everything that was going on at Theranos and defrauding people and $9 billion of capital being wasted. And the hypocrisy would come in because all the people that were praising her are not pointing out that, they were wrong. In fact, she was not the icon that they were making her out to be. Maybe hypocrisy is not quite the right word there, but I still expect more mea culpas from the people who were on the Theranos bandwagon and are now just pretending like it never happened. Okay, finally, we got to go into our close look at the FDA here. So our last item in the news, we always try to end on a happy piece of news because, as Steven Pinker and others point out, we seem to be evolutionarily programmed to focus on the bad news, and that's somewhat understandable, right? If you're gathered around the campfire with the rest of your tribe, it's kind of more important for you to notice that there are some giant cave hyenas stalking around the outside of the campfire, some bad news there, than it is to notice that There's maybe some delicious cotton candy plant hanging out there. I don't know. I don't know Siberian botany. I'm pretty sure there aren't any cotton candy plants, but you know what I mean. More important to notice the bad news and the good news for survival. But we don't live in tribes around campfires anymore. And it's important to notice the good news now. So let's focus on some good news. Oh my goodness, at least good news for the United States. Not so good news, I suppose, if you're a fan of Los Catrachos, the Honduran soccer side. The United States soccer team won last night in a big way, 4-1, even moved ahead of Panama on the table by goal differential. The United States is now tied with Canada and Panama at 5 points behind Mexico on the table. The top four teams will move on to the next round, although the top three teams out of the octagonal will go on to the World Cup, and the fourth place team was going to have to play another team from another region to play into the World Cup, so to speak. People are calling a must-win game last night. It was not a must-win. It really wasn't. It was kind of a close to a must-not lose, though. So the United States with 5 points from two away games and one home game. That fits the soccer adage of win at home, draw away, and you're golden. Didn't quite go in that order, but 5 points from two away games and one home game, that's pretty good. I still think USA soccer is completely nepotistic and corrupt in some ways, not as bad as FIFA, but still corrupt in some ways. And I question whether the dysfunction at US soccer is going to be big enough to cause a poor performance from our golden generation. Because we really do have a golden generation coming through right now. I mean, the go-ahead goal last night scored by Ricardo Pepi. He's 18 years old. Pulisic is the old man, probably our best player, most famous international player. He's already won a Champions League with Chelsea. He's the old man at 23. Of course, soccer is a young man's game more than ever right now. You look at strong club sides on the international scene, it's pretty rare to see somebody over 30, which makes it even more amazing that Ronaldo and Messi can do what they're doing at 37 and 33 or so. But that's the good news today, at least from the heart of the ADK, straight out of the ADK is where I am. That's the good news. The United States 4-1 in soccer yesterday. Good job, boys. Now let's move into our close look at the FDA. I promised to talk about this, the FDA and the regulatory burden. Yesterday, we're going to get to some horrific examples and then to a bigger picture. I mentioned Scott Alexander's amazing piece yesterday. You should go read it. Just search Scott Alexander in the FDA. You'll find it. He has that great article in there about a Boston hospital was able to use a treatment for babies, for infants really, with short bowel syndrome. These infants would die. They couldn't digest food, but you could save them by giving them nutrients in IV lines. But they had to be the right nutrients, and it turned out the ones that people were using in the U.S. Were causing liver damage in these infants. However, due to some research in Europe, people found out that if you added a certain type of fish oil to the nutrients, the liver damage would be avoided. Well, the FDA said, nah, not so much. We're not going to let that happen. And then a hospital in Boston started doing this treatment anyway. And the FDA said, okay, everybody else, your babies can still get liver damage, but that hospital in Boston can be the only one allowed to do this fish oil and not have the babies with short bowel syndrome get the liver damage. And everybody else said, what? Come on, this is insane. And the FDA said, well, okay, you can cross state lines and go get treatment at Boston with our permission. But you know what? Just to be on the safe side, you can only get the permission if you show us proof that you need it. And that proof is letting your infant have liver damage. So you could only go and get this treatment to avoid liver damage if you already had your infant already had liver damage in the first place. And that's the FDA. So that's the type of example that you can find there. But there are tons of other examples out there. New York University journalism professor Charles Seif just won last year a huge FOIA, FOIA request and lawsuit because the FDA didn't want to release it. So it was a lawsuit related to FOIA, FOIA requests. He won a huge lawsuit against the FDA. over the years, he and his students have found at least 600 cases where the FDA, listen to this, the FDA, the United States Food and Drug Administration, they identified fraud or misconduct in the testing of a medicine, a pharmaceutical, a drug, and they identified misconduct, fraud, that meant that the drug being brought to market was invalid, but they won't tell you what the evidence is. They won't tell you in some cases which drugs aren't there, and they allow these drugs to stay on the market. 85% of the cases, first of all, they don't tell you at all, but Seif and his students were able to find about 15% of the cases by various cross-referencing and stalking on internet and figuring out through alternative means, workarounds, which drugs were actually being held by the FDA as these drugs had been approved because of a faulty process. And so C found that was able to identify which drugs they were in only 15% of the cases. So 85% of these cases that the FDA discovered that its own process for approving a drug was faulty, the FDA didn't announce it and allowed 85% of these drugs to stay on the market for at least a while, years in some cases. For example, let's go back to 2003 here, and the quote from Seif is that the FDA has repeatedly hidden evidence of scientific fraud, not just from the public, but also from its most trusted scientific advisors. Yeah, they don't even tell their own advisors working for them in analyzing these studies what's going on. So in 2003, you had this case with the antibiotic Ketik, and David Ross, who was the official in charge of reviewing the safety, he said, in January, over reviewers' protests, FDA managers hid the evidence of fraud and misconduct from the advisory committee, which was fooled into voting for approval. Only when the press started reporting about odd goings-on at one trial site did this all come out, and then Congress got involved, and that's how we know about this with Ketik. And these sorts of things, Seif gives you a great example of the Lancet keeping papers in publication because the FDA won't release its data saying that after investigation, this study was false, even though it was peer-reviewed, even though everything else, peer review is vastly overrated among teachers and a lot of professors, by the way. So Seif says that you know, the Lancet kept these articles out there. And so for years, doctors around the world are looking these things up and they're saying, oh yeah, here's the study, it's safe, we're going to go ahead and use this. And these drugs stay out there. It's hard to emphasize, this happens all the time. You can't overemphasize it. The FDA in 2011, they learned that an audit of a Chinese site involved in a clinical trial of an anti-clotting agent called apixaban had turned up evidence of fraud. Personnel had been fiddling with patient records. This is related to an article in New England Journal of Medicine, which said that this drug was safe, produced a significant reduction in mortality. But the FDA knew that wasn't true. They knew that the study had been compromised, that the approval process had been compromised, but they didn't tell anybody. They didn't say anything about it. And they allowed the label, even the label that still came out from the FDA on apixaban, said that the treatment resulted in a significantly lower rate of all-cause death than treatment with some other things. They used data from the site that they knew was flawed. The label carried a claim that they knew was wrong. And that went on for at least 3 years, it stood out there. There's another case with Cetero. Cetero was a research firm that the FDA employed, sort of outsourced to do some tests. And then there's this great ProPublica article about it from 2013. And for 3 years, the FDA, even though they had uncovered, in the FDA's words, egregious and pervasive wrongdoing at this testing lab, Cetero's testing lab, they still didn't do anything about it. And they wouldn't even tell the public which drugs had been affected. That is terrible. I don't know. Have I made my point that the Food and Drug Administration is constantly failing us? They are incompetent. Now, you ask yourself, well, what's the big deal? Well, we've been talking in the segment about Basquiat's idea of seeing what is unseen, right? You have to look and not just see what the broken window, but you have to see what is unseen. You have to see what the money that would go to replace the broken window could have done, or the time or the labor or the love that could have, that went into fixing the broken window. It could have gone into something else. You know, maybe we'd actually have a working drug for Alzheimer's. Maybe we'd have some serious longevity results. You have to remember, right? Old age is a disease. I'm very tired of people my entire life. People don't think old age is a disease. Maybe we'd have better treatment for the 100,000 plus people around the world who die of snake bites every year. Yeah, that's right. It's a huge number. Die of snake bites. Way more are injured, some with amputation and stuff like that. Way more than over 100,000. Well, it's definitely still over 100,000. But I think it's like five times the number. Maybe we'd have better antidepressants. Maybe we'd have better ADHD medicine, because the people wouldn't be burdened by this ridiculous process with the FDA. Years and billions of dollars to get anything proved while people are dying. Maybe we'd have hit on the big one. Maybe we'd have even better cancer treatments. Cancer treatments have been improving over the decades, but maybe we'd be even better than we are today. This is hard, right? Because you're trying to convince people to see how good the world could be if the FDA weren't so abysmal. If people can't see, you know, why or how things could be better, then why should they push for it? Inertia is powerful. People need a reason to get moving. And life is pretty good now, right? We have PlayStation. We have straight teeth. Everyone has a chef cooking for them at Red Robin or Texas Roadhouse, except me. I got to drive an hour and a half to get to a Texas Roadhouse out right here. I'm straight out of the ADK, right? But we share chefs, keep the cost down for everyone. We all have our chefs now. And people forget, because life is so good now compared to just how it was, you know, in 1900 or even 1940, 1960, 1980. I mean, now I have the entire world's knowledge in my pocket, in a phone. Didn't have that in 1980, 1990. So life is good now, but people forget how life could be so much freaking better if we didn't have things like the FDA sucking so much. All right, I have to tell you one more story about regulatory burden here before we get to some overall cost ideas. This is the Bostwick consistometer. I think I first learned about the consistometer from John Stossel. Not sure. I think back in the 90s, John was talking about this. The consistometer is a metal ramp. It costs $600 on Senco, but all it is a metal ramp. Now, what is the Bostwick consistometer used for, you might ask? So consistometer, I'm pretty sure I'm pronouncing that right. It looks like consistometer. It measures the consistency of various tomato semi-liquid products. Ketchup, tomato puree, tomato paste, tomato fluid, tomato ooze, tomato goo. I don't know how many different tomato things there are, but there are many. I'll read you a little bit here from the USDA now. It's the U.S. Department of Agriculture now. This example of disgusting regulatory burden. Read you that in 1 second, but just in case you're not clear why we have the Bostwick consistometer, it's rent seeking, right? Of course, they can justify it all they want by saying, oh, the government has a fundamental need to know if your tomato puree or your tomato paste or your ketchup is flowing at this rate or that rate. We need to know, the government needs to know to keep you safe. It's always about your safety. To keep you safe, we have to know exactly how thick your ketchup is. And if it's not thick enough to be called ketchup, we have to call it tomato paste. And if it's not thick enough to be called tomato paste, we have to call it tomato puree. Because otherwise, you poor, poor fool, you might be confused and think that tomato paste is tomato puree or even ketchup. Egad. Oh, the humanity. The humanity. A little epizeuxis for you there. So, yeah, it's rent-seeking. The real reason that we have it is not anybody's safety, but because the big guys want to keep the little guys out of the market, right? They don't want the big guys in the ketchup market don't want the little guys to be able to put out a cheaper, easier to put out product and call it ketchup. They don't want the little guys to be able to compete with them. So they make it really hard to produce something called ketchup, and they make all these ridiculous rules that are hard for little companies to follow, and then only the big guys can make what's actually allowed to be labeled as — labeling is a big thing with FDA and the USDA. It's what's labeled as ketchup. Only the big guys would then be allowed to do it. It's called rent seeking, because even though they're not adding value to the market, they're seeking to use the government as a club to increase their own profit share, as if they're charging everybody rent, everybody else in the market rent, just for being there. So let me read you this. This is great. This is from the USDA's, from the USDA, but it's actually hosted on the FDA's website, which is pretty funny. So here we go. This is just a random section from the Bostwick Consistometer. So what you do to measure whether your thing is tomato paste or tomato puree or ketchup, you put your product at the top of the ramp, and then you open the gate, and then you see how down it goes. Listen to this paragraph. Paragraph 3, label declaration. Each of the ingredients used in the food shall be declared on the label as required by the applicable sections of parts 101 and 130 of this chapter, except that the name tomato concentrate may be used in lieu of the names tomato puree, tomato pulp, or tomato paste, and when tomato concentrates are used, the labeling requirements of section 155.191A32A, I'm not making this up, and section 159.191A32B do not apply. Yeah, it's nuts. Now, here's the actual physics or engineering of it. This is great. Section B, the standard, part one, the standard of quality for ketchup is as follows. The consistency of the finished food is such that its flow is not more than 14 centimeters in 30 seconds at 20 degrees Celsius when tested in a Bostwick consistometer in the following manner. Check temperature of mixture and adjust to 20 plus or minus 1 degree Celsius. I mean, that's 5%. Is that really a tolerable amount of error? I don't know. Might not be safe. The trough, that's the ramp leading down from the pen at the top of the consistometer, the trough must also be at a temperature close to 20 degrees Celsius. Yeah, that's real precise. Close to 20 degrees Celsius. Adjust end-to-end level of Bostwick consistometer by means of the spirit level placed in trough of instrument. Side-to-side level may be adjusted by means of built-in spirit level. Transfer the sample to the dry sample chamber. Fill the chamber slightly more than level full, avoiding air bubbles as far as possible. Oh my gosh, it goes on and on and on. For highest accuracy, your readings, if they vary more than 0.2 centimeters, you must repeat it a third time. It's got more and more and more stuff like this. This is where your tax dollars are going. We're spending money on things like this to measure whether something is ketchup or puree or paste or tomato concentrate. There's this precious 2009 paper from two food engineers at the University of California at Davis on the Bostwick consistometer. I highly recommend it if you want some morning chuckles. So, yeah, I just love that example of the Bostwick consistometer as an example of regulatory burden. So how big is the regulatory burden? Well, 2019 CEI Competitive Enterprise Institute report put it at $1.9 trillion annually. That's a conservative estimate. That's a pun, by the way. That's about 10% of our GDP. So what's unseen with that? What are we missing here? We see the broken window. Everybody sees that, you know, oh, people could die if we didn't have the FDA in place. Or, you know, they never even think about having private food monitors and drug monitors anyway, but people could die. Well, I'll put it this way, $1.9 trillion annually, that's $14,000 per household. So what could you guys do with $14,000 per year in your household? Vacation, maybe see the world, better education, more medication, home improvements, keep everybody safe, maybe a bigger car so you could have three kids instead of two. And yes, it is true that we have some studies that show that car size and the car seat laws influence how many kids that people have. They encourage them to stop at two because they can't afford a big enough car to have three car seats. Can you imagine a billion happy Americans singing in perfect harmony? I can imagine that. I can see that. And now it's important to keep in mind, guys, you can't just say, well, I'm such a good person that I will happily give up $14,000 for my household because it will save lives. No, the whole point is that the FDA costs lives. It is horrible. Every single day, they are making decisions like that liver damage to infants in Boston decision. Every single day, they are delaying drugs like with the AIDS drugs, cost hundreds of thousands of lives. The FDA is killing people. And also, you can't logically make that argument, oh, I'm such a good person, I will give up $14,000 from my household to save lives. You can't logically make that argument because the entire exercise here is to see what is unseen. The entire Gedankensatz, the entire thought experiment here is to imagine what could be better, to see if we had a functional FDA, then what else could we also have? That is the point of the exercise. All right, so today we had a theme, if you didn't notice, by the way, right, with Donda. Again, go listen to it. Jail, Hurricane, and all the other songs on there. God Breathed, oh, so much good stuff. Brilliant. We talked about Hammer Time in Australia. We talked about the Helen Hulick case in 1938, and she wore slacks, and she is praised by the woke, by at least my woke friends, for standing up for her right to dress herself, even against the argument that when she was dressing herself, she was hurting people. Then we had some great news with, at least for American soccer fans, and Sam's Army, the U.S. winning soccer game last night. We looked at the FDA and this horrible burden that they are imposing on us. It's killing people. The FDA is killing people. We could have a much better world. Please try to see what is unseen. See that better world that we could have if our regulatory state weren't failing us, if we had a fantastic FDA. Let's put the fantastic back in FDA. Let's make the FDA fantastic again. Okay, now, since we had religious art here today, we had a theme, and because so many people don't see what is unseen, like Gerard Manley Hopkins sees what is unseen in a bird, we're going to end today with The Windhover by Gerard Manley Hopkins. Hopkins, fantastic poet, a little over 100 years ago, he wrote often in something called that he invented called Sprung Rhythm. Here we go, some religious art, seeing what is unseen. The Windhover, Gerard Manley Hopkins. To Christ our Lord, I caught this morning, morning's minion, kingdom of daylight's dauphin, dappled on, drawn falcon in his riding, the rolling level underneath him, steady air, and striding high there, how he rung upon the rein of a wimpling wing in his ecstasy. Then off, off, forth on swing, as a skate's heel sweeps smooth on a bow bend, the hurl and gliding rebuffed the big wind. My heart in hiding stirred for a bird, the achieve of, the mastery of the thing. Brute beauty and valor and act, oh, air, pride, plume, here buckle! And the fire that breaks from thee then, a billion times told lovelier, more dangerous, oh, my chevalier! No wonder of it. Sheer plod makes plow down sillion shine, and blue bleak embers, ah, my dear, fall, gall themselves, and gash gold vermilion. I'm out of here for today, folks. We got another banger episode tomorrow. Take care.